Shall we begin?
Let's begin now.
You're listening to the Dishin' and Swishin' podcast on HoopFeed.com.
Hey everybody, it's David Siegel, and I'm glad to welcome you back to another Dishin' and Swishin' podcast, and it's NCAA tournament time, the favorite time of the year. March is here. I couldn't tell by looking at the amount of freaking snow outside my window, and I know that Charlie Cream has been seeing it when he's in Bristol as well. Charlie, what about this winter that we're having? How about it?
Well, it is brutal, but I gotta be perfectly frank, I'm West Coast based. So my sympathies go out to everybody on the East Coast this winter, but I've enjoyed a very, very temperate winter and a lot of sunshine and no ice.
Well,
no
I think it's only appropriate that you guys should have that it should be bright and sunny out there because it's been a great year for the Pac-12, and we'll get into all of that. But you know, welcome back to the podcast, Charlie, and I'm looking forward to kicking around some bracketology with you. First, so people understand right off the outset. When you go about doing what you do and trying to project who's going to make the tournament and who's going to be placed where, just give some of the factors that people may not know go into what you're looking at in terms of everything from geographics to RPI and, you know, the things that help make your job that much more difficult.
There are elements, and it's sort of steps and it's stages. And so, the first thing is I try to watch as many games as I can because that's what the committee does. They are assigned certain conferences to watch and pay attention to. They get game tapes sent to them. Unfortunately, I don't have that luxury, but I also have the luxury of satellite television and maybe some time. And so I watch as many games as I possibly can. And so that's obviously one part of the evaluation of the X, just the teams themselves. What's the quality of this team? What's the worthiness as they compare to other teams? And then, of course, there's the metrics that we get so neck deep in every year. RPI, who'd you beat? Who'd you play? Where'd you play them? What was the content of that particular game? Was there an injury during the season that we have to take into account? So there's that. And then that kind of gets me to the list of 1 through 64, and then beyond, obviously, teams that are close and teams that are a little bit further away but still fairly close. And then actually, in a lot of cases, the tricky part starts. It's the bracketing part. And that's where you mentioned geography. That comes into play. And it makes putting the bracket together is like putting a puzzle together, and some pieces just don't fit because of rules that have been established. We don't want teams from the same conference playing each other immediately in the first or second round. There's a rule for that. We don't want there's a rule that stipulates they're not supposed to play before the regional final, actually. We don't want teams that have played each other during the regular season to play each other in the first round, if it's at all possible. So the committee goes there to avoid those things. And that makes that's where the puzzle part comes in. And then trying to decide what makes the most sense for the bracket with relation to balance and competitive balance and geographical balance. Because one of the things that is a little bit more part of the thought process in at least from the bracketing part for the women's tournament is it's still a burgeoning sport. It's still a growing sport. You still want to be able to maximize attendance. You want the games to look good and sound good on television. So this is the committee's trying to do the best it can to getting geographical sense, but it can also be at the forfeiture of competitive balance and making a fair and equitable bracket. So that kind of encapsulates most of what goes into this, and it does get sometimes it's not that hard, and other weeks it's very challenging, and usually there's a couple of challenges along the way, and the committee's job is not easy when you throw all that into the mix.
One of the things that's intriguing this year, right off from the get-go, is the fact that the high seeds have the ability to host not predetermined sites for those first 16 sites. And then just to make things more fun, Louisville can't host when they're possibly is one of them. So looking at that scenario, now, first of all, let's talking about Louisville. Now, if I understand correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, because Louisville can't host, basically whatever they're seeded, whoever the next highest seed that is in their section, though, will have to host. So, for example, in your bracket, you have them as a 3 right now. Obviously, Stanford may be a 5, and what you have, they can't host because they're going to be facing number 4. So it would then go to number 6, Texas A&M, in your bracket.
Right, and that's exactly how it would work. The next highest seed who submitted a bid would be the host of that sub-regional. But, you know, for instance, this year, Louisville, as you said, cannot host, and that's why we're having this conversation. Ohio State also did not submit a bid. So, and Ohio State could be a team that would fall into that 6 range. So Ohio State, from that perspective, in all likelihood, if you want to play the scenario out that currently sits in the way I see it, Ohio State couldn't be placed with Louisville either. Because then you'd be moving on to a host school that would be the 11. And did they bid? Did they not bid? It gets a lot more complicated at that point. So, it would be the next highest seed who submitted a bid, which in most cases is available as a 6, or if Louisville happened to be a 2, then that would be available to the 7. I think most of the 7s teams that would be in the mix for a 6 or 7 submitted bids.
Boy, they do certainly manage to make things more difficult, don't they, the way that all this goes on. No question about that. And then, of course, you know, just dealing with the same little thing, we do have the Princeton conundrum, where Princeton undefeated. Right now you've got them as a 6. Now they conceivably could be thrown in with Louisville because I know that they have requested to host. But as of now, it's not looking likely that Princeton's going to be elevated enough to get to that point, is it?
If Princeton, say that again, if Princeton got to that.
They're most likely not going to get elevated to the point where they'll be able to host.
Not in a top 4 scenario, no. The scenario for them to host would certainly be maybe being placed with Louisville. And the reason I say that is, honestly, they were a big mystery. They were kind of an unknown. And if the committee hadn't done what they'd never done before, which was release that sort of mid-season, mid-February, here's our top 20 teams, here are our top 4 season order, I would not have had a really good feel about how the committee felt about Princeton. The undefeated says a lot, for sure. But how much does it say when you evaluate most of the competition? This isn't to say Princeton didn't try, and they didn't schedule up. They did play Michigan, they did play Pittsburgh, and they beat them both. And they beat them both handily. And they obviously should be commended for that. But they haven't, Princeton hasn't played a game of real deep meaning since the beginning of January, really. And that creates a problem in their evaluations. How do we look at them? And the committee then, with this mid-February release, gave us a clue, did not have Princeton in its top 20. So my logic now is keeping Princeton at 6 is, well, the committee, by not putting them in the top 20, said then they're not a top 5 seed. So the best they can be is a 6 in mid-February. Well, they haven't played a game since then that would elevate that profile in any way, shape, or form. By playing nothing but Ivy League opponents since then, in my mind, it would be illogical for the committee to now say, oh, now they're a 4. Well, they haven't done anything to really improve themselves in the way we evaluate this since that time. So I have to, that's logical to me. I have to go with that logic, and that way Princeton only ends up as a 6.
You know, the one thing that, you know, personally, you know, looking at Princeton's schedule and talking to Coach Banghart, and when I had her on the podcast a couple weeks ago, you know, one of the things that I don't think gets enough credit, and to be fair, if this committee had to look at the way that everybody has to schedule and play their games, it would be a real nightmare. But the fact that Princeton plays back-to-back games every weekend and no games during the week pretty much sets them up on a tournament schedule before things even get started for the tournament. And I think that that's a tough schedule for somebody to keep, and I would like to see a little more credit somehow be given to that. But as I said, you know, for the committee to look and say, well, you know, the, well, what about, you know, somebody in the ACC that has to play, you know, Notre Dame, Duke, North Carolina, and Florida State in four straight weeks games? You know, how do you judge that? How do you weight that?
Well, and that's the thing. I don't know. There's, because there's lots of different ways to look at it. Because I see what you, I certainly see what you're saying about Princeton in having to play those back-to-back games. But I would take, just as a devil's advocate thing, not that I believe one way or the other strongly, but I would take the other side and say, because they play on Friday and Saturday, they can play games carefree of classes. You don't have to worry about if you're Florida State, for instance, and you're playing on a Tuesday night, you're playing at Virginia, but in, then you've got a class the next day that you have a test in, then that makes it more difficult to play the game in my mind. So there, I think there's certainly enough different ways to look at that stuff that it's really hard to incorporate it, because it's so subjective, and there's so many different people's eyes and ears on stuff like that. I don't know that you'd ever get a real way to evaluate those kinds of things.
Well, you have an excellent point. Let's go on to another hot discussion right now, pretty much on Twitter in particular, is, you know, a pair of Dougs got things going. The AP's Doug Feinberg and DePaul's Doug Bruno have each been talking about RPI lately, and Doug Bruno talking about how people, you know, RPI starts with no numbers, and, you know, teams start higher to begin with, and they should, and Doug Feinberg saying that RPI, you shouldn't be rewarded for who your opponents are, but the truth is somewhere in the middle, that the RPI is a useful tool, isn't it?
I believe it is. Now, I also don't believe it's perfect. I think what we're seeing in other metrics that are being used, I think those are more valuable. They're better predictors of outcomes, and that's a part of this too. Although the committee's not predicting outcomes, but you want predicting outcomes is a way to evaluate who's a better team and who's not a better team. So I don't think the RPI is by any means perfect, but we can't get so down on the RPI that things start to get discussed that just simply aren't true or aren't really hitting accurately, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the RPI is measured by your winning percentage, your opponent's winning percentage, and the winning percentage of your opponent's opponents. And some people have a problem with that last element. And I love both Dougs in these kids. They've been super helpful to me over the years, and they're brilliant minds when it comes to the sport. But the opponent's element does give you some. It does add a value, because it tells you the quality of the win you had. If you're beating teams if you're losing to teams that are then turning around and just losing to everybody else, then how good was that loss? How good was that win? If you're beating a team and then they turn around and lose four of the next five, well, was that win that impressive? Because everybody's doing that, so that should be a measure. It's the only way to go deeper into the value of a schedule, the value of a win, given the metrics or the parameters that RPI has provided. I don't think it's useless at all to say, why should you get credit for who the other teams play? Because it says to what those opponents are and who they are, like whom they played and who they beat. And if they also didn't turn out to beat anybody good, then you beating them, what does that mean exactly?
And that also leads to the mid-major conundrum versus the power conferences and the success ratio of some of these schools and the records of teams in the mid-majors versus teams in the power conferences. You know, you end up with a number of teams that have two, three, four losses in a mid-major that may become a one-team conference, and you end up with, you know, people thought this was a bad year for the Big 12, a down year, for example, and there's seven teams being listed as getting in the tournament right now from that conference. So that, I would say, the RPI and strength of schedule, that really must come into play when you're dealing with those types of programs.
Oh, it does. And trust me, I don't think this was a good year for the Big 12. And I do think it was a sometimes you look at the RPI and you do scratch your head. And this year with the Big 12 is one of those years. It's listed as the number one RPI conference. I don't think anybody who watches games would say that's the best conference in college basketball. That being said, it's such a bad year. I mean, I know people have criticized me, or which is fine. That's part of the deal. Or they've questioned my decisions to have these Big 12 teams in. And my response is, give me some alternatives. And that's where the problem lies. No one's coming back and giving the actual real substantive alternative. It's a bad year. Most years is not great near the end. This year, to me, is exceptionally bad near the end of the bubble, the fence, large pool, however you want to define it. There aren't really good alternatives. West Virginia, I've had in, I've had out, I've had back in. Now they're back out again. But it wouldn't be that way if there was somebody else out there who showed enough. Now, some people have thrown out some of the teams from the West Coast Conference. Not a bad league at all. But what's interesting is the people touting the West Coast Conference are the same people criticizing the Big 12, that all the Big 12 does is beat each other, and that's how they're able to elevate their RPI, and those are their only good wins are against one another. Well, that's exactly what's happened in the West Coast Conference. And it's somehow that part of it gets lost in the conversation when people are trying to tell me that San Diego or Pacific belongs. All of their wins, all of their best wins are against one another, too. It's the same thing. And we can't evaluate, if we're going to be critical of the Big 12 for that, can't evaluate the West Coast Conference, or just using that as an example, or any other league differently. And I think that's one of the traps that we all fall into with the mid-majors is we want to give credit to certain wins by a mid-major that we would never give credit to for a team in one of the Power Five conferences. And that's something that gets lost in the argument, too. Someone will tell me, well, I'm trying to just come up with an arbitrary example. Chattanooga's a bad example because they did actually have some great wins this year. But, so-and-so mid-major beat Wisconsin, and they beat Penn State, and they beat Texas Tech. And we would never – those are not good wins. We would never give credit for those wins to West Virginia and say that's part of their resume. But people want to do that for the mid-majors as if they did something special. And we have to be consistent in the way we look at this. And that's part of what I hopefully bring to the table is some, kind of a level of consistency and looking at teams the same way and not evaluating them differently. That being said, this year's bubble is bad, but there's a lot of really good mid-majors. They just happen to right now be the teams winning those conferences and are the automatic bids.
Yeah,
if we get some upsets in some of these leagues, and the Florida Gulf Coast and the Chattanoogas and the Green Bays of the world don't win their conference tournaments, we won't have as big a bubble problem because those teams are going to be in the tournament, and then the automatic qualifier from those leagues will also be taking the spot of potentially a West Virginia or a TCU or a Miami or something like that.
And of course, I'm as into the fanciful thoughts of the upstarts making their moves as with anybody. And perfect examples, like you said. I mean, I would be thrilled to see if they didn't win their conference tournament. I'd love to see West Point, who is sitting there, for example, with a 22-6 overall record, 14-4 in conference. I'd love to see them make the tournament and watch them take on somebody instead of a West Virginia with a losing conference record in the Big 12, as much as I like Mike Carey and our Connecticut's own Bria Holmes there. But, I think that's a big factor in the way that people look at it, too, is they would rather see, the Patriot League upstart in the tournament instead of yet another Big 12 team.
I completely see that, and I wouldn't mind it either, frankly, as just personally as a fan. However, I don't know how you then, year to year, create any true consistency about whom you select unless if you had, maybe if you had a rule, you have to finish 500 in your league, and that would open the door for a little bit more of what you're talking about. But if you're, if the goal is to select the best 32 at-large teams, then you have to take all of the things we've already discussed and we discuss every year into account, and then pick the best 32 teams.
Exactly.
And if you truly believe that Army, and just using this example that you brought up, if Army, if you truly believe Army is better than West Virginia, then absolutely, by all means. But if you, if you're just putting Army in because, well, we need to give someone else a shot, and this would be more a more friendly, fan friendly matchup because it's different. I think we're getting in too much into the subjective and not enough of the objective. And then how did Army differentiate itself from Richmond or from anybody else who does well in the Patriot League on a year-to-year basis?
You're exactly right, Charlie, and that's the point that I really do want to emphasize as well is, while, you know, the fanciful thought of somebody like a West Point, should American win the Patriot League, who won the individual, for example, would be great, I would not pick them in a head. If I'm looking at a head-to-head matchup between West Virginia and Army, I'm taking West Virginia. So your point is exactly right, and that's what I want to emphasize, that as much as it may not sit well with some people that a team with a below 500 conference record in a power conference makes it into the tournament, if the goal is, in fact, to put together the best teams in one spot, then that's what you do. And that's the point that is truly important to recognize and something that you have just very well said.
Exactly. I think if we ever got to a point where they did make that rule, and there are people that bang the drum somewhat loudly for a rule about finishing 500. I know my colleague or cohort on the men's side, Mr. Lenardi, has been saying that for a few years. He firmly believes if you don't finish 500 in your league, then you just automatically are discounted from consideration from the at-large pool. I think it's an interesting way or direction we could go, except you're never going to get the powers that be to agree to that. You might even find an AD or a president somewhere in one of the Power Five conferences to approve that. You're not going to get all five.
I mean, the other thing is, this isn't the Met. Okay, I mean, it's a different game. Okay, in the Men, we've had Virginia Commonwealth, Butler, San Diego State. We've had all of these schools from smaller conferences that have seniors. I mean, here, the teams that are in the power conferences have the seniors too, and there's a reason that they're playing on the power conference teams. So it is different, and it's difficult to try and put from one side to the other, but that's what we frequently do try. Our fans of the game certainly do love the men's game as well, and it's wonderful that they do. But sometimes they try too hard to put one side to the other, and you can't do that. So
no, it's two different sports, and I think it has to be evaluated like that, and enjoyed each for the unique things that they bring to the table, for sure.
So let's get into some of the nuts and bolts here. And Maryland, you emphasized on Twitter, Maryland jumped over Tennessee to take that number one spot, not so much because of anything that Tennessee did, but because of what Maryland did. And that they had played so well recently in the tournament. If any of the four number one seeds that you currently have, Connecticut, Maryland, Notre Dame, or South Carolina, were to lose, say, in a championship game, would Tennessee be able to jump back up to a number one, or are those four pretty much going to be in there anyway, much like South Carolina was last year?
I think it's a five for four spot scenario, and I don't think UConn and Notre Dame have anything to worry about. South Carolina has little to worry about. And so I think it really comes down to, if you're really breaking it down in its most granular possible way, it's what happens with Tennessee in the SEC tournament and likewise Maryland in the Big Ten. If they both run the table, it gets real interesting, because that means Tennessee would have likely beaten South Carolina. Probably then Tennessee elevates above Maryland once again. Probably anything short of that, and Maryland does stay above Tennessee. Maryland makes it to the Big Ten final and loses, and Tennessee makes it to the SEC final and loses, but almost beats the South Carolina. Then it gets a little bit trickier. I think the only way South Carolina doesn't maintain its spot is if Tennessee wins the SEC tournament, Maryland wins the Big Ten tournament, and South Carolina loses in a semifinal or a quarterfinal game in the SEC tournament. But although you brought it up, you alluded to it, we saw last year as South Carolina lost in the semis of the SEC tournament. And frankly, I thought that was going to be enough to move Stanford into the number one spot and have South Carolina as a two, and it didn't work out that way. South Carolina, as we found out, was firmly planted in that number one spot and didn't move because of that loss.
Okay, I'm going to run the risk of pissing off all the people from the West Coast right now. But, you know, wonderful city, wonderful place, great fans. Why do they keep having these things up in Spokane where no one wants to go?
I don't know. They seem to do well. I think I brought this up on Twitter with someone. The NCAA isn't arbitrarily picking in Spokane and banking on Oregon State being there to drive the only way to drive attendance. It's a good basketball area. They've always done well. And the fact that they keep going back to Spokane speaks to either one of two things. That Spokane does well, does a nice job at putting on a regional and the fans turn out to the liking of the NCAA, or not enough people are bidding on these things. And I think we, as fans of the game, we much would rather have the former than the latter be the case.
Sure.
You know, and we hope Spokane's not getting picked as a default, because nobody else on the West Coast or in the West, the Mountain or Pacific time zones is putting a bid in to host a regional. We're never going to get that information. I'm certainly not. No one from the NCAA is offering up that kind of stuff, the inner workings of the bidding process and who discusses and what the discussions are. Assuming that it's the first, that the NCAA is just happy with the way Spokane puts on a regional and the crowd turnout they get, that would be why they keep going back there. But I do understand your point, because it's created a dilemma in this particular bracket, and it usually does every year.
As I say, every year's bracket.
Who the heck do you send there? Right. It's far. It's remote. There's very few teams you can select to say that's a geographical that makes geographical sense to send them there. There are really only maybe on a given tournament two or three teams that you can say that about, and I might be being generous when I say three.
Yeah, and then what ends up happening is you end up with a situation like this year, where say Oregon State is a very solid two, right in the middle of the pack of the twos. So you're not going to send them out against the, you know, all the way out there against a Maryland, who I would say confidently is the number four one. If you're going to try somewhat to do the S curve as well, you know, you're not going to send Oregon State there to be a home team against number one Maryland, and you end up not with the teams that you want anyway out there.
Exactly. There's really no good way to do that this year. If the seeds hold or I'm accurate in what I'm projecting, Maryland I had is the final number one, and I had Oregon State as the final number two. If you put Oregon State in Spokane, and Maryland would be the one there, they'd have to go there because the other three number ones would get geographical preference. If they're doing it the way that they've said that they typically or they want to do it, then there's no way to balance the bracket properly. When you have the worst number one and the worst, I shouldn't say worst because it doesn't reflect how good teams
right,
exactly.
are.
When you have the final number one and the final number two in the same region, you've created an imbalance for the other number ones.
Sure.
And the number two that they may have to eventually face to get to the final four. And that's, they have done this in the past. I think the year we saw Connecticut and Rutgers in the same region, or a year we saw Texas A&M and Baylor in the same region. Not only were they, it was a done geographically, but now you're talking about teams in the same conference that were placed, and it created a lot of disgruntled fans and media and head scratching, and we never got good explanations other than we wanted to make it better for the student athletes, so we wanted to make it geographically friendly, but it didn't create a fair and balanced bracket, and there was no explanation that the NCAA was able to give that could make it such. So that's my dilemma. It's happened in the past that way, where they've gone geographical, and then the very next year they've completely reversed field on that. I don't know if it was a reaction to the criticism or not, and they went the exact opposite to avoid such sort of conflicts. So the Oregon State dilemma is one of my greatest issues in this bracket, trying to do the bracket every week, trying to know what the committee would push itself toward. But and the other thing, too, is because of that, they never release anything beyond the top four teams in the tournament. We know the number one's in order. We're not going to know anything else.
Right.
So they don't have to necessarily say that they did it purely out of geography. They could say that that's the way it worked out, and we would have to buy that because they're not going to give us the proof source to that. I would highly question at any point that Oregon State is going to be anything more than the number seven team overall. I have them at number eight right now. I don't foresee a scenario that's likely to happen, given the seasons that all these teams have had so far, where Oregon State would be anything above seven. That would still create something of an imbalance, and as you said, it would make the S curve or any facsimile thereof irrelevant.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very difficult for the other twos, Baylor, Florida State, Tennessee, to lose somewhat early in their conference tournaments for them to be dropped below Oregon State in that type of scenario. You know, of course, in the good old days, we used to also say, okay, ACC team is going to be going to Greensboro because that's where they're close by, and so forth, and accordingly, except now we've got the ACC team is located in the Midwest, and the Big Ten team is located on the East Coast, and the SEC team is on the East Coast. You know, these conference realignment has screwed all this up, too.
We love football, but it has killed basketball's geographic sensibility. That's for sure.
You're talking to a guy that covers UConn. You don't have to tell me about what it's killed.
Yes, I mean, and that's an interesting point, because in all of this conference realignment, UConn, the school, the basketball school, the entity that is basketball, has been hurt probably more than any singular program in the country when you're taking both the men and the women into account. To go from the competition that it had playing in the traditional Big East to where things are now in the competition within the conference and the notoriety of the conference is, wow, what a big, huge swing in the wrong direction. So as much as we laud UConn's women's team, and as we should, the remarkable success that they've had, the unbelievable way they play, they were done no favors by what happened in the football world.
You know, let me ask you a question then. You know, one thing that has always struck me when I look at UConn in specific and where that leads, Tulane, you had as had last on this past Monday, you had them as one of the first four out. Okay, now that I'm sure has been adjusted by other things that have happened and such, but you get teams like South Florida, who is a solid team, and Tulane would be the next best example, that play UConn, and they lose to them by, you know, between 20 and 50. What does that do to the committee's perception of other teams in the conference that UConn can handle them so easily? Do they realize that it's just that UConn is that much better than most teams, or does it hurt them that they lose by such large margins in conference?
You know, I think the committee probably looks at it this way, and I think some recent bracket history would back what I'm about to say up. I almost think those games are thrown out for those other teams, the UConn games, because UConn does that, because UConn does that to everyone, it's hard to evaluate the level of which they've done it to a particular team over another one. You know, they just beat up on South Florida the other night, and we know South Florida is a good team, and that game was outside of the first 5 to 6 minutes was not particularly competitive once UConn got its legs under it. So I think that a lot of those games are just I sort of dismissed them. When I'm looking at Tulane, and I looked at, you know, they lost 4 of their last 5. I do also recognize that 2 of those losses were to UConn, and I sort of then eliminate those. But the reason that they tumbled is they also lost to Tulsa and to Temple. Those to me, that's a more important way to evaluate Tulane than saying that. Well, they played UConn, they lost by 50. Well, a lot of teams have lost to UConn by 40 or 50, so UConn's so much better than everyone else, it's hard to use them as any sort of measuring stick for anyone else. Maybe that's the simplest, most condensed way to say it. I wouldn't say it's not fair to the other teams in this conference because it looks like it's not fair right now. Now, what it'll probably ultimately do is help teams within that conference elevate themselves over the years, and we'll probably see better programs come out of that league as a result of UConn's excellence. But for now, it's hard to even use UConn in the equation when you're evaluating those other teams.
Okay. Looking at some of the mid-majors and some questions about ones that have gotten teams in and ones that are looking at one conference right now. You know, the A-10, you've got both George Washington and Dayton are both solid programs. Anything other short of an early round knockoff by one of them, they're both probably in. Yes.
Yeah, I think those they're going to both be solidly in the tournament. I don't think there's any question. I think if some amazing stars align, I think GW even would have an opportunity to be a host. I don't think it's likely, but I don't think it's impossible either.
Okay. I'll throw out a couple. You just tell me if they have, you know, if they have any shot of making it if they don't win their conference tournament. Okay. I mean, you had mentioned earlier, just to get off the top, Green Bay would be a yes, Chattanooga would be a yes, Gulf Coast would be a yes.
That is correct. Yeah.
Okay. Now, what about somebody? What about, like, you know, if James Madison were to lose in the CAA, them also?
I think James Madison's in too, and I think. I'd be more worried about James Madison if there was more to choose from, as we kind of talked about earlier how the bubble is strikingly bad. If there were a lot more teams winning right now toward the bottom instead of losing, you know, we talked about Tulane, we talked about West Virginia, I think I threw out TCU at one point. All those teams, Miami, but they just keep losing. But everybody behind them keeps losing too. So that what that does is it creates a softer fall for the teams like James Madison.
If Middle Tennessee State turns it around with Parker not there any longer and manages to win that tournament, can they make it and Western Kentucky not make it, or is Western Kentucky one of those that you think is probably solidly in too?
I think they're probably in as well. I would be a little bit more I put a little bit more of a question mark on Western Kentucky, but I think they, again, for the same reasons to a large degree, I would put the Hilltoppers in the tournament still.
And I would assume that teams like Quinnipiac and Maine, despite really strong resumes, those conferences are going to be one conference teams.
Yeah, those are one-bid leagues. I've got a lot of questions about Quinnipiac in the last couple of days. If they win 2 more games in the tournament, end up with 30 wins, how could they be excluded? Well, 26 of those 30 would be outside the top 100.
Yeah, the MAC is having a down year.
Yeah, it is. They didn't get a lot of help, frankly, from you point to Marist, because Marist is usually been one of those teams we're talking about as a mid-major bubble type team, but not this year. And the rest of the league was really down. And I don't see how you can put a team with merely 4 wins in the top 100 in the tournament despite the gaudy record. My suggestion to Quinnipiac would be go out and win that tournament and dominate the way you dominated the league all year.
And try scheduling it to, you know, that team that's a little north of Connecticut, try scheduling them next year.
Yeah, and that's when we run it. That's when it runs into those questions from fans. Well, no, nobody will play us, and I don't know that any of us really know that how much truth we can get out of that. It might be true. Maybe Quinnipiac reached out to UConn and to all kinds of teams in the Northeast. Maybe they try to play Syracuse and Rutgers and Penn State, and they always get rebuffed. Or maybe they don't. They don't.
Yeah.
But none of us know that. Okay, the committee doesn't necessarily know that, and it would get so bogged down in gray area that we'd never get a tournament picked. You have to just go on with what you have, what you see, you know, things that are a little bit, that are definitely concrete and not someone's idea of the truth. You just have to go by what the truth is. And the truth is 26 of the 30 wins were outside the top 100, and I don't know that that's good enough to be an at-large.
You know, that's you bring that up, and there's a fine line there. I mean, I always have been one of those people preaching that, you know, I'd love to see some of the big schools take on some of these more higher quality mid-majors and challenge themselves with them and challenge the other programs. But, you know, a lot of the programs, like, you know, like a Princeton, like a Marist, are, you know, they want a home and home, and a lot of the big programs won't do that. And then they say, so then the mid-major says no, they don't want to travel there. So, well, who are you hurting? You know, yeah, you're not getting the, yeah, you're not, you know, you're going to get somebody else that's willing to come play you at home, but you're not going to get that game against that high seed that you want to see and challenge the program. So, you know, it's a catch-22, that's for sure, when you get to that situation.
If you're UConn, if you're UConn, are you going to give up a home game where you can pack the place? These programs still have to somehow try to sustain themselves or do the best they can at sustaining themselves. You can't just willy-nilly every year give up a home game or two to try to get some of these mid-majors home games, and so it's more competitive. There is a balance, and we probably haven't found it yet, but it's unrealistic to just throw out there, well, no one will play us. I think the point you brought up is spot on. Yeah, they'll probably play you, but you're going to have to come to their place. And that's just economics. That's the world we live in. If you don't think that's fair, I guess my answer would be tough, because life in that kind of world isn't fair. Money's keeping these programs afloat. They have to make as much as they can. Most women's programs are in the red every year. For the ones who can sustain themselves, they need to keep doing that. Or we start to have all kinds of problems all over college sports.
Agreed, 100%. Looking at some of, you know, as we wrap things up here, looking at some of the programs that are in the middle there, say a Rutgers at 6, Texas at 8, A&M, Stanford, Ohio State, can any of these teams dramatically improve their lot by making a big tourney run, or is pretty much everybody where they're going to be right now, except for maybe a move one spot or so?
I think you've hit it. One spot is probably where those teams are looking. Their resumes, their seasons have been kind of what they are, and there's not really anything they can revise with them. I think, you know, Rutgers or an Ohio State, those two teams you mentioned, if they were to happen to go and win a Big Ten tournament, there's an outside chance that they could rise more than one seed line, but there's still a lot of teams that you'd have to leap over. And I think, you know, we kind of know that. When we always analyze baseball standings, toward the end of the year we talk about how many games out of first place is a team, but we also talk about how many teams in between, because that those teams are playing games as well. Well, it's the same thing here, in a sense, that even an Ohio State team that was to, say, beat Maryland in the Big Ten final and win a conference tournament, but if the teams in front of them, say, you know, Washington, Syracuse, George Washington, Stanford, if they have similar runs in their conference tournament, how much can Ohio State really bust through that wall? They will a little bit. But are they going to leap over all of those teams in order to move up two full seed lines and get in the position to be a top four? Probably not. It's because it is a whole resume thing. We're not just evaluating this next week's worth of games. in that Ohio State team that beat Maryland was also an Ohio State team that lost to Illinois, for instance. And there's, you have to take that into consideration as well.
And then last thing is, while we welcome back some of our people, like Vivian Stringer coming back, and it's been a while since we've seen, you know, Pittsburgh in the tournament and some of these other programs, it's nice to welcome them back. Washington and Mike Nabors, good to see you. It's just not going to be the same without Andy Landers and Georgia and Middle Tennessee State, as we're talking about, and, you know, some of these other programs. Rick Majerus, Brian Georges. Boy, that was awful. They did look similar, but, you know.
They do, and then they're both outstanding coaches and unique coaches. So.
Well, you're bailing me out now. but it'll be strange not seeing them in the tournament.
It will be, but I think that's one of the beauties of the tournament, is that every year we get a little bit different. I mean, one of the big complaints about the women's tournament is, oh, it's the same team. You know who's going to win, or you know who's going to be in the Final Four. It's not any different. But there are differences. You maybe have to look a little bit more and peel away a couple more layers. But you just mentioned them. There are some unique things going on. The Princeton story is unique and it's interesting. What that does to Princeton's seed, you know, we've discussed that. But nonetheless, if they come into the tournament undefeated, that's new. That's unique. We haven't seen that before outside of a UConn or a Notre Dame. So that'll be fun for people to tune in and see. They haven't played anybody but Ivy League teams for 2 months. Now they're going to get a chance as an undefeated team to play someone outside of the Ivy League. How does that work out? Some of these other schools that have been clamoring for respect, Florida Gulf Coast. We talked about Green Bay and Chattanooga. They're probably going to have opportunities with where they might end up being seated to play teams that where they're not going to be. It's not going to be a David and Goliath type scenario. They're going to be on equal footing in play. Now they might be teams. You know, you might get a Florida Gulf Coast playing a Texas, for instance. And I'm just throwing that out. I
sure.
That's in my bracket. I'm just throwing that out. Well, guess what? That's Florida Gulf Coast's opportunity. It's a neutral site. It's against a Power 5 team. If you want to talk about every year not feeling like you get the quote-unquote respect you deserve, this is your opportunity. Go out and show the world that you are and your league is better than the national perception has been. Or carry the flag for your league to say, hey, maybe we should get stronger consideration every year to schedule a little bit better, to maybe get two teams in the tournament if it warrants. Those kinds of things. This is going to be the opportunity for those schools. Those are unique stories. Those are fun things to watch. And it's a little bit different this year because I think we have more teams like that. I think you go down to James Madison even. Now, you know, you've added a fourth team into the conversation. That's more than we usually get in this mix every year. It's usually, going back to the odds.
It's usually Marist, Gonzaga, Green Bay, and move on.
And that's it, exactly. And it's usually not all three in the same year.
Yep.
So we have a unique opportunity this year, and that's something else that I think we should embrace. And while, you know, the likes of Marist and Georgia not being there, you know, maybe, you know, the traditionalists and the two of us says, oh, it's too bad because, you know, they're perennials. But with that, we get it, there's new opportunity, and I think those are some of the things that we really can embrace and enjoy.
Absolutely, and I think you hit on a very important part that I want to mention just in closing. These teams from these mid-majors, with the success that is going on with some of the programs this year, they are not just 12s and 13s. We've got 6s, 7s, and 8s. So they've got legitimate opportunities to go out there and win some games and like you said, prove their respect. 8-9, if you're looking at if Gulf Coast is, in fact, a 9. Same thing with James Madison. Same Chattanooga is an 8. You know, those are teams that potentially can go and prove that they deserve those higher seeds going forward. And I, you know, that's important. And I hope that the people embrace that as well and take advantage of the fact that there's so many games between the Watch ESPN app and the Fox networks and all that are showing the conference tournaments, and now there's so many opportunities to watch games. I hope people do, in fact, watch them.
Charlie?
Oh, it's almost too much. There's so many games on television now, and we're lucky for the advent of cable sports networks and satellite television, because it's opened up so many doors for so much more information.
Well, I suspect we're going to be seeing you everywhere on ESPN's coverage for the next couple weeks.
I think my name might get mentioned once or twice, yeah.
And, of course, everybody follows you and hope they, you know, ask you questions at Charlie Cream on Twitter. You will answer just about everything that I've ever seen thrown at you, so you're to be commended for that, and including some of the recurring questions again and again, but you handle them all so well, and I thank you for indulging all of us fans and for making time for us today.
I always love being with you. I think you do a great job, and it's always fun every year to get on and chat.
Charlie, take care, and enjoy that sunny weather that you have out there.
I always do.
Bye-bye.